The TSA now says some travelers won't have to remove their shoes, belts, or jackets when going through airport security. And the FAA has expanded the use of electronic devices. What's this mean for air travel? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. With all the air travel news and with the holiday travel season upon us, we thought it would be a good idea to get an update. My guests this hour, airline pilot Patrick Smith, author of Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel. Also, what to do about that annoying chatterbox in the seat next to you. We'll talk flight etiquette with consultant Luann Alameo. An air travel update after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Air travel has been in the news a lot lately. Of course, the disturbing news on Friday when a gunman blew through a security checkpoint at LAX and fired rounds from an assault rifle. Police apprehending that suspect. Not before, though. He shot and killed a TSA agent. Six others injured. The TSA officer, the first to be killed in the line of duty in that agency's 12-year history. Well, in the category, though, in good news in air travel, the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, now says some travelers won't have to remove their shoes, belts, or jackets when going through airport security. And the FAA has expanded the use of electronic devices on board aircraft. And, of course, we have the holiday travel season upon us, so we want to spend the hour updating ourselves on air travel. Coming up in just a few minutes to spend with us the rest of the hour, we'll have airline pilot Patrick Smith to field your questions, give us some tips. He's the author of Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel. But first, let's check in with Iowa Public Radio's Rob Dillard. Rob Dillard in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Ben.
We heard the news that you reported on last week. The Federal Security Director for the Transportation Security Administration in Iowa says the Des Moines International Airport is the first in the state to open the TSA pre-check line. How does that change things? What is a pre-check line?
Yeah, Des Moines International joins about 100 other airports across the nation as part of this program. It basically means that passengers can it's going to benefit frequent flyers most immediately, those who fly on American, Delta, United, and U.S. Airways out of Des Moines anyway. These people will be allowed to go through the screening process without removing their shoes, their outer jackets, their belts. They can keep the laptop in the bag. They don't have to take out that little bag of liquids anymore from their bag. They'll still have to separate out those liquids into smaller containers, but they won't have to remove them from their bag. So it's a much faster process. One passenger I spoke with at Des Moines International last week estimated he's probably saving around 5 minutes getting through the checkout.
Did the TSA provide an explanation as to how security is upheld at a good level while implementing these faster lanes?
Yeah, TSA acknowledges that the security risks, the people who pose security risks, that's a very small number of passengers. Most people are at very low risk. TSA officials say this program will allow them to focus their resources on watching out for those high-risk travelers.
Okay. And if a listener is interested, how do they qualify for one of these expedited lines?
Well, as I mentioned, the frequent flyers, if they've been designated a frequent flyer by one of the four airlines participating right now, American, Delta, United, and U.S., they will be allowed through this line. But there will be a number of passengers selected at random, people who have gone through a kind of screening process from the TSA that has notified officials that they are at low risk to no threat in their traveling. And they get this information from people who go online and get their tickets from the various airlines. People at random will be selected to go through this pre-check line. They won't know, however, until they arrive at the airport to board their plane and get their boarding pass. It will have it stamped on the boarding pass.
Okay, very good. Thanks for that update. Iowa Public Radio's Rob Dillard. Talking about air travel the rest of this hour, and we want to ask you if you have some questions about commercial air travel, perhaps a question about later on. We'll have someone who will join us tell us about air travel etiquette, or you can just ask a general question about air travel or share with us a pet peeve about air travel. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Joining us for the rest of the hour, Patrick Smith, joining us by phone, a commercial airline pilot. He's host of AskThePilot.com and author of Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel. Patrick Smith, welcome to River to River.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me on.
And people may know you from your articles in Salon.com. Right?
Yeah, I was a columnist at Salon for about 10 years, and my column there was called Ask the Pilot, and eventually the column was discontinued, and I moved it over to my home site, which is simply askthepilot.com, and from there readers can click through and learn about the book and everything else I do.
Okay, here's your chance to, on our airwaves live, Ask the Pilot, Patrick Smith, 1-866-780-9100, or get in touch with us over our Facebook page or tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's go to the travel news that we've been hearing about, the Friday news. What are airline industry people saying? What are you saying in reaction to the shooting at LAX and the first death of a TSA officer in the line of duty?
Well, one of the questions that's been coming up is whether or not this is an indicator that maybe TSA screeners ought to carry firearms.
Mm-hmm. They do not now, none of them.
No, well, TSA screeners are not law enforcement officials, despite the blue shirts and badges that would suggest the contrary. These aren't law enforcement officers. They don't have power of arrest. They don't have the power to detain you. They're security screeners. So I think the leap to giving firearms to these employees is getting a bit above and beyond the reaction that we should be seeing. And I think it's a terrible idea for a whole host of reasons.
Yeah, share a couple of those.
Well, it would be a power grab and, what's that expression, mission creep. TSA is there to screen our luggage. And that's not to, demean their larger purpose of keeping us safe. But one of the things here that nobody ever talks about is that the real job of keeping terrorists away from airplanes doesn't really belong to the screeners on the concourse. It belongs to the people working backstage. And by that, I mean TSA, FBI, CIA, law enforcement, looking to discover plots and break up plots before they get to the airport. Chances are, if a terrorist or criminal has already made it to the airport, he or she knows how to bypass whatever measures we have in place.
Let's talk a little bit about – yeah, go ahead. You wanted to add to that.
Well, I think the TSA's pre-check program, which you were talking about during the intro, is a very interesting new approach. I think it's a good approach. What I don't like about it, though, is that passengers are forced to pay to subscribe to this program.
So we didn't have that come out, and that's exactly where I was going with my question. These expedited security lines, you can be a frequent flyer, but you have to pay on top of that?
Yeah. TSA has this apparatus at the airports that in so many ways is irrational and really doesn't do a whole lot towards making us safer. And so people realize that, even the agency itself realizes that, and their response now is, okay, well, you can pay money to bypass these poor protocols we have in place. I have a problem with that. What I like about it, though, is it finally is owning up to the fact that every single person who flies in this country can't be subject to the same criteria and seen as a potential threat of the same level. We have to move away from that. It's a nice idea, but in a country where you have 2 million or more people flying every day, it's just not a sustainable approach. And we need to move towards a risk-based approach, and that gets into profiling, of course, which is a bit of a dirty word, but we're not talking about racial or ethnic profiling. We're talking about dividing people up on a whole score of different data points, everything from how they bought their ticket to nation of origin, to where they're going, to all this different criteria, and looking at people in separate categories that way. That's not a perfect system either, but we're never going to have a perfect system. We're never going to be 100% safe, and we need to stand back and realize that too.
Are you worried all of these expedited security lines will somehow compromise security? Terrorists are, of course, looking for the weakest link, and it wouldn't be a surprise to have a terrorist in a sleeper state for years, becoming a frequent flyer, to get into the least security line.
No, that doesn't worry me. Touching on what I just said, we're never going to be 100% safe, and we have to compromise somewhere along the way, short of turning our airports into fortresses and strip searching everybody who flies. The real underlying irony to all of this is that the success of the 9/11 attacks really had nothing to do with airport security in the first place, and this is something I talk about in an essay in my book. Conventional wisdom holds that the hijackers on 9/11 used box cutters to take over airplanes, and that's wrong. That's not at all what happened. They weren't relying on weapons. They were relying on the element of surprise and exploiting our understanding of what a hijacking was and how a hijacking was going to unfold based on the decades of hijackings before that. Really, crews were trained in what was called passive resistance, which, loosely put, was if somebody wants to hijack your airplane, let them do it.
Mm-hmm. Nobody had imagined what they were going to do with those aircraft, or very few people had imagined it.
It had come up. I mean, some people were thinking along those lines, but that wasn't the predominant mindset at the time, and that's what they took advantage of. It was the element of surprise. It had nothing to do with hardware, with weapons. If box cutters hadn't been allowed, they could have used anything.
What would happen today if we had a similar situation? Are the staff, the pilots, the flight attendants, also the passengers, so aware now that with the slightest disturbance, people spring into action?
Yeah, the awareness is the number one issue there, and I'm not at liberty to get too into the details of how crews are trained and what our response would be, but just the response of passengers alone, I think, it wouldn't be anything. Basically, the template that was used on 9/11, that blueprint, is really off the table from a terrorist point of view. Terrorists that can't really afford to move forward with a scheme that would have such a very high likelihood of failure. And that was the genius of 9/11, is that as long as the men didn't chicken out, it was really all but guaranteed to succeed. Mm-hmm. And just the opposite is true today.
Right after 9/11, we heard a lot about air marshals. Do we still have air marshals on flights?
I shouldn't say one way or the other.
Okay.
But I think the concept of having the air marshals was a little bit of closing the barn door after the horses were out. Again, the 9/11 template, that blueprint really wasn't a workable scheme after 9/11, so maybe that's something we should have had in days prior, not since.
If you just joined us, Patrick Smith is my guest, the commercial airline pilot, host the website askthepilot.com, and author of Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel. Join our conversation with your questions about commercial air travel. 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. The other bit of news we had, Patrick Smith, in our introduction, the U.S. FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, ending a longstanding ban on using portable electronic devices on planes. What does that mean more specifically for the air traveler?
Well, it's important for people to realize that there have been different rules pertaining to different devices for different reasons. For example, one of the reasons you're not supposed to have laptop computers out during taxi or takeoff or landing is because they're heavy and risk becoming a projectile in the event of a deceleration or impact. And, you know, who wants to be hit in the head with a laptop computer going 200 miles an hour? Also, the laptops would impede an emergency evacuation. That's why you can't have them out during taxi, can't have your tray tables down, because if suddenly everybody's rushing for the exits, people would be tripping over the tables and computers. And so even with the new changes, computers still have to be stowed during taxi takeoff and landing. The new rules pertain really only to tablet devices and smaller.
Okay, so those are not as projectiles, not as threatening, deemed not as threatening.
No, and you have to draw the line somewhere, I guess. I mean, a tablet is a projectile the same way a book could be a projectile, but, yeah, I mean, we're not just banning any object, you know, outright. We have to be reasonable about it, and I don't have a problem with people being allowed to use tablets.
We have we have airplane mode on a lot of our tablets,
right,
and so forth. What is the threat there to the electronics of the airplane?
Right, and here people should understand, too, that any device, no matter the size, if it has cellular capability, it's still that capability needs to be off for the duration of the flight. And there's a lot about this we don't really know. We don't understand fully. That is how cellular interference can affect onboard cockpit technology. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence out there that cell phones can sometimes interfere with equipment, and that's a hard thing to prove and quantify, because the types of interference, it's stuff that's likely to be very transient and intermittent, maybe not noticed at all. Meanwhile, there were two accidents, one in Switzerland and one in New Zealand, and this is going back a number of years, but still, that investigators think may have been caused in part by telephones.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there'll ever be a time when passengers can make phone calls during the flight on their own cell phones?
Well, the incidents I just mentioned were a while ago, and those were smaller planes. Modern aircraft are shielded very effectively against interference. It may be something that's technologically feasible in the near future. However, I think ultimately it comes down to being a social issue rather than a technological one. And by that, I mean, do we really want to be sitting on an airplane with 250 people all talking on their phones at the same time?
You're right.
That's not why the rules exist. It's really not. But eventually that's going to be the question. And you know, it's kind of funny, because today U.S. airports are just so damn loud, especially compared to Europe and Asia, where airports are very quiet. You've got people talking, and layer upon layer upon layer of public address announcement, and then those damn news monitors, the TVs at every single gate that you can't turn down and you can't turn off.
Yes.
It's not until getting onto the airplane, usually, that we often finally find some peace and quiet.
Right, and then to imagine that as the chatterbox. That
right.
You're going to
One solution might be to maybe have a chattering and a non-chattering section, like the old smoking section on airplane, where these people can sequester themselves and drive each other crazy but leave the rest of us alone. Or maybe, you know, people could be allowed to go to a certain area of the plane one at a time to make a call, something like that. But the idea that simply any and everybody can use their phone at any point during a flight is just horrifying to me.
Patrick Smith, author of Cockpit Confidential, with us. We want to get to some calls and some of our social media. This is on our Facebook page, posted by Fifi. She wants to talk about how air travel reinforces a class caste system in a supposedly classless society. The worst is at O'Hare, where first class passengers get a shorter security line than those of us in steerage.
Well,
that's just the way it is.
They're paying more to fly first class. Some people have nicer cars and bigger houses than other people, too.
Okay. Let's go to Heather in Des Moines. Hi, Heather.
Hi. Yes. In the last year and a half, I've flown quite a few round trips from Des Moines to St. Louis, and I just got back the other day, and I had the pre-check thing on my boarding pass. So they moved me over to a line where there was no line, and I went through. I didn't have to take anything off or take my liquids out. And so I got through that line very quickly, and then I had to wait for the passenger that I was flying with. And it took him about 10 to 15 minutes. And during that time I was waiting, I never saw anybody else go through that pre-check line. It was just standing there empty while the other line was very, very long. And so I'm just wondering, what are the basic qualifications for you to go through that line? And it kind of seemed stupid that it just sat there empty for so long. And I'm just confused on how that all works.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. You'd need to go to the TSA's website and see what the application process is all about. I did that once at one point, and I noticed it was sort of complicated, and there is a cost involved. And remember that it's a new program, so the fact that right now maybe the lines aren't or are non-existent maybe at some of the pre-check locations. But I think eventually that's going to change as more and more people sign up for it.
Heather, thank you from Des Moines.
Thank you.
John in Iowa City, what's your question? Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi.
Go ahead. What's your question?
I just wanted to clarify something that your guest had said. Frequent flyer with United. And here about 2-3 flights ago, I got that pre-check, not knowing what had happened. I did not pay for it. I went to TSA in Portland, Oregon, where I'd landed, and said, why and how did I get this? And they said, United Airlines approved you. So there was no money involved in it. It was simply, I use United, and I use it quite frequently, so somehow I got this pre-check. So
really?
I just wanted to clarify the payment because there was no dollars involved.
Maybe could it be the case that frequent flyers, the commercial airline, foots the surcharge, Patrick Smith, because just to keep them happy?
It's possible, but I'm not sure. So we probably shouldn't say for sure one way or the other. But that's encouraging to hear. We need more of that. That's good news.
Okay.
And, like I said, I think TSA is beginning to realize its role and its limitations on the front lines, and is beginning to move towards that risk-based approach rather than the everybody who flies is a potential terrorist strategy, which for so long didn't work. I wish it didn't take as long as it took 11 years or whatever to get to this point where they're finally moving in that direction, but it's encouraging that they are.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that's almost kind of funny, or would be funny if it wasn't so head-shakingly baffling and depressing, is pilots and flight attendants. Only until very recently, on-duty crews had to go through the same security screening as passengers, taking our laptops out,
everything,
going through the metal detector and so on. And in fact, at a lot of airports, we still have to do that even now. There is a program in place at some airports that allows us to bypass that, but at most airports still, we're still subject to the same screening as passengers. Meanwhile, a lot of other airport employees, including employees with full access to aircraft, caterers, cleaners, mechanics, and so on, bypass TSA security altogether.
Mm-hmm. We have to take a short break. We'll be back with Patrick Smith, commercial airline pilot. I want to thank John for calling from Iowa City. Perhaps some clarification. Here's a quote from the Des Moines Register on those expedited lines. Passengers can apply with U.S. Customs and Border Protection, which costs about $85 and requires the applicant to travel to a screening center in Washington, D.C. or Indianapolis. The TSA is selecting certain low-risk travelers who have not enrolled in pre-check to go through the expedited line. If that clears up anything, at least partially. We'll be back with Patrick Smith to talk more about air travel, author of Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel. Also, we'll have a consultant join us to talk about onboard etiquette. What are your questions, your comments about air travel? 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find us on Facebook. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We just heard about it in the news, the anti-bullying summit going on, the governor's summit going on in Des Moines. Tomorrow we'll dedicate the entire hour to the ideas and proposals being put forth at that anti-bullying summit. We'll also hear from a young Iowan who was bullied and who now uses that experience to help others. Tune in tomorrow, River to River, over the noon hour. Today we're talking about air travel, several items of news concerning air travel. And also we want to get ahead of the curve. The holiday travel season is upon us, and make sure we have the best tips possible when we're traveling to see loved ones during the holiday season. Helping to do that with us, Patrick Smith, commercial airline pilot, host of AskThePilot.com, and author of Cockpit Confidential, everything you need to know about air travel. 1-866-780-9100. Join our conversation or tweet us at IPR Talk, post a message on our Facebook page, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Patrick Smith, before we go back to callers and some other things, let's talk about what concerns most people when air travel is concerned. There are mysteries of life like, I don't know, the meaning of life and then the Rubik's Cube, but somewhere in the mix is how are airline tickets priced? Because that's hard to unravel, isn't it?
It's hard for me to unravel. You know, a lot of it is so market dependent. Some particular cities, flying tends to be more expensive from those cities than from elsewhere. It depends on the competitive dynamic of that city and which destination markets we're talking about. I mean, it's often cheaper to fly from New York to Europe than it is to fly a domestic segment half that distance, and that's because of how many people the levels of competition on that market, how many passengers fly that route, how much they're willing to pay, which class of service are they willing to pay for, how many carriers are flying those routes, and so on. It's not as simple as a flight of X distance always costs X dollars. It's much more complicated than that, and airlines really have this down to a science as to how they price their routes, and it's not necessarily something that the layperson could understand.
We could probably go into this for the rest of the hour, but briefly, what is then the strategy that passengers should take to get a cheap ticket?
Well, buying your ticket early has always been the best way to nail down a cheap fare. Not that all fares aren't relatively cheap nowadays, and allow me to interject something here. You know, I think this is lost on a lot of people. The fact that airfares today are about half of what they were 30 years ago on average. If we adjust for inflation. And that also includes adding in all those ancillary fees that airlines love nowadays and passengers despise. It wasn't really that long ago that only a small segment of the population could afford to fly at all. Mm-hmm. And now almost everybody can afford to fly. And I think that's lost on people, especially younger people, who don't remember how expensive flying once was. And, you know, we often hear about this golden age of flying, which I think is a myth to some degree. You know, this time in years past when, you know, everybody dressed up to fly and the service was great. And maybe it depends somewhat on your criteria, but I would argue that if ever there was a golden age of flying, it's right now. Mm-hmm. And people hear that and think I'm crazy, but first and foremost, I mean, fares are affordable for almost everybody. That didn't used to be the case. Flying is safer right now globally than it's ever been. Despite all the fiscal woes that the airlines have had dating back to 2001 or so, you know, they've nonetheless maintained this impeccable safety record that rarely gets mentioned. And on top of that, flying is mostly reliable. About 85% of flights arrive on time. That's a strong number. It's getting stronger. And, you know, not too long ago, I was sitting on an airplane and I was in economy class. And I had in front of me a video screen with a choice of about 150 movies to pick from. And I was remembering, you remember the days when they used to show a movie up on the bulkhead screen?
Oh, yeah.
And you could hardly see it. And 99 times out of 100, it wasn't anything you wanted to watch anyway. And then you had those scratchy plastic earplugs that stuck into your ears, those plastic headsets. And now you've got on-demand video, you've got Wi-Fi on airplanes. You know, these are things that didn't really exist 10 or 15 years ago. It's not a bad experience, really, for all of the contempt that people have for it, but I think we've gotten spoiled.
Airline pilot Patrick Smith with us, Cockpit Confidential, the title of his book. Tim is with us from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Tim.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
And sure, sure
a little
thing.
Disclaimer here. I'm the director for the Cedar Rapids Airport, so I just want to tell you that I'm finding Patrick. I've enjoyed your articles throughout time, and I share them with a lot of people, customers, and people who work at the airport. And you kind of touched on the subject that I wanted to ask about. And that's pricing, because a lot of times we're unfairly criticized that our prices are higher than neighboring airports. And we have absolutely no say whatsoever in airline pricing. I'd ask that maybe if you would just touch on the subject of fare buckets so people do understand how fares are set. I don't even believe they're actually set by a person anymore, but set by computer models. But if you could touch on fare buckets, I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
Well, Tim, I'm probably the wrong person to ask because I don't really understand the science of airfare pricing all that well, other than to repeat what you just said, which is that carriers use complicated computer models to come up with these fares, and it depends on the time of year. It depends on all the competitive variables that I talked about a few minutes ago. As a general rule, airports that are dominated by a single carrier, the fares tend to be somewhat higher out of those cities, and I guess that stands to reason.
Lou is with us from North Liberty. Tim, thank you for that call from Cedar Rapids. Lou, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Hey, we're doing
great. Thanks
for
taking my call.
Sure thing.
I'd just like to pay a compliment to you, Patrick, and to your fellow pilots. Back in May of 2010, I flew into Boston to see my daughter, and we had it was a flying postcard. It was a beautiful day, and the captain flew over the harbor. He came around, and he landed. When he landed, he just tiptoed the A320 in. The spoilers engaged, but he did not use reverse thrusting, aerodynamic braking. He lightly, gently put the nose wheel down, took the second to last turn off. And I just went wild over that. And passengers were looking at me like I must have been drinking or something. But when we got to the gate, when we finally got off the plane, they were standing on the jetway. And one of the flight attendants, the pilot, and the first officer, and I went up to him and I said, "Sir, did you do the landing?" And he goes, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, bravo, that was the most beautiful landing." And how I described it to you, I described it to him. I said, "My compliments, it was a sterling landing, what a great flight it was." And he kind of socked the first officer on the arm and he said, "Finally, someone appreciates my work." And we all laughed and I continued on, but I don't think people appreciate enough. My brother-in-law was an airline pilot. He flew for Ozark for 30 years. Wow. He was a spectacular pilot, and I grew up around him, so I understand that. And I don't think people appreciate how hard you guys work, how hard the whole system is to get going and keep it going.
Lou, thanks for that experience and that compliment to the pilots of this country.
Yeah, thank you. And I think one of the reasons that people don't appreciate what we do is they don't really understand what we do because they're led to believe that airplanes are so computerized and automated nowadays that pilots don't really do anything. If I had a dollar for every time I heard that, and there's a big essay in the book about that, it's one of the most stubborn and persistent myths in all of commercial aviation, I think, the idea that pilots are so, or that airplanes are so automated that the pilots are there just kind of as a backup. That's so wrong for so many reasons. The automation in an airplane, compare it to maybe cruise control in your car. I mean, it alleviates certain tasks at certain portions of the journey, but just the way cruise control can't drive your car from Iowa to Florida, the autopilot can't fly your airplane from Iowa to Florida either. The automation isn't something that flies the airplane. The crew flies the airplane through the automation. We still have to tell it what to do, when to do it, how to do it. There are all different modes we use and so forth. And I think people would be very surprised at just how busy a cockpit becomes at times, even with the automation on. And by the way, more than 99% of all landings are still, I don't want to say old-fashioned because that's not really the right term, but are hands-on. Performed by hand. The airplane is not landing itself automatically. The pilots, either the captain or the first officer, depending whose turn it is landing the aircraft. And meanwhile, 100% of all takeoffs are hands-on manual. There's no such thing as an automatic takeoff anywhere in any airplane.
Patrick Smith is with us, an airline pilot and author of Cockpit Confidential. Patrick Smith, we would like to add to our conversation. Luann Alameo is with us of Luann Alameo and Associates. That's an organization that consults on etiquette and image. Hi, Luann.
Hi.
We wanted to kind of shift over and give some attention as well to air travel etiquette.
Yes.
What do you think are the most problematic areas in air travel etiquette?
Well, it was interesting listening to the program because I always, when I fly, after I start deplaning, I always thank the pilot and his crew for the safe flight and the safe return. And before I wrote my book, that was the one thing that I asked when I was on flights is, what is the number one attention detail that you would like passengers to remember? And it was to say please and thank you and not just give me or would you, but just to say please and thank you and have a little bit of consideration. And I thought that was so simple, yet something that we forget and we eliminate to do in our distress maybe or in just our pleasantry of flying.
Mm-hmm. Why is, I mean, not just in air travel, but tell us, what is etiquette? Why is it important, briefly?
Well, I like to call it the three C's, and that's compassion, consideration, and kindness, if you want to say, even though that doesn't start with a C. Those are the three areas that we need to think about when we interact with anyone. And anytime we have any kind of interaction with a person, there's a level of etiquette or decorum with anything, whether it be at the grocery store or at your job or at church or whomever you meet on the sidewalk. If somebody is taking up space, who's going to move over? I mean, there's a level of decorum, and you just need to keep those three adjectives in mind with any interaction with a human being. And I think sometimes we get stressed, and so we are not at our best, or maybe we simply don't know what the level of decorum is, or sometimes we are a little egocentric, and mm-hmm. I'll just be honest.
Okay, here's one of those examples that I have, and I don't think I'm the only one who has this sort of a little twinge of guilt when I recline my seat in the as a passenger. Do I have to be how considerate do I have to be of the person behind me? Because my seat does recline. I paid for a reclining seat, but what should I do there, Luann?
Well, you are expected to be able to recline that seat. But in these days when the plane is smaller and there's not as much space, you might want to give some consideration to the person that's behind you. And if you want to give it some attention, you can just say, I'm going to recline now, especially if they happen to be a larger frame person or if they're eating, mm-hmm. because then the tray table may end up a little closer to that. I mean, just be kind and considerate. That's basically it. Just let them know with some dialogue.
Patrick Smith, what do you have to say about that?
If you are going to recline, please do it slowly.
Yes. I was just going to say, release that button slowly. You're right.
The people who come hauling back all at once with no warning, I call them assault recliners.
I like that.
And heaven forbid if you have your laptop
exactly.
on the tray in front of you, it can get caught between the seat back and the tray, and you can crush your screen, or the person reclining will crush your screen.
Mm-hmm. Or the food that's there is going to end up scattered all over everywhere.
Can the person behind you, Patrick, refuse to let you recline all the way in any way?
Maybe by threatening you and then forcing your seat back up into the upright position, which is something I've experienced a few times. You know, then there's the risk of an altercation. No, if the seat is built to recline, then the person should be allowed to recline.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, one thing I noticed that I think is interesting, and what the cultural reasons for this might be, who knows, but I noticed that passengers on international flights tend to be more civilized and more polite than the crowd on domestic flights. I fly routes both out of the U.S. and within the U.S., and it just generally flying overseas, there just seems to be a more dignified atmosphere to the whole experience than what we have in interior United States.
And maybe that's because of the longer flight, and you know you just need to be relaxed, because I've done some of those international flights, and maybe it's just the fact that it's going to be a long, enduring flight. I'm not really sure, but I would tend to agree.
What about, Luann,
yes.
in terms of going through the security before we get
yes.
on our planes, what
yes.
etiquette should we keep in mind going through security, even though, given that most of us still have to take off shoes and jackets and laptops
right.
and stuff
well,
like that?
Well, I've done a little study myself with the flying that I do, and I've loaded up on all the jewels and all the things that you're not supposed to do just to see exactly what would happen. And inevitably, I have to remove it all. So I guess what I'm saying is that be kind and be considerate. If you want to take all of those jewels, you're going to have to put them inside the suitcase, check them in, or carry them on. But make sure what you're wearing is rather simple so that you're not holding everybody else with all of your jewels and belts and buckles and bags and all those sorts of things. Be considerate with that, because like I said, I've done my own self-test, and I think people think, oh, well, I can pass through the scanner. I'm not going to have to remove it. But you do end up removing it.
Mm-hmm.
I've done my own self-test. So I think just to be considerate, make sure that you have all those things removed. And it's easier to wear slip-on shoes, so you're not having to tie and lace all the big boots, all of those sorts of things, so that you can get through in a timely manner.
Also on that list of happenings on board that may concern us, how do you, Luann, articulate to a seatmate when they're doing something rude or annoying? I guess most often, what? Chatter, right?
Chatter. And I've had that happen before. And the best way I've found is to reply, I would really like to talk with you, but I am so exhausted, or I have work that I need to do here on my computer. Mm-hmm. And that usually is the impression that you want to give, and usually people pick up on that. Or you can just close your eyes if the person is not taking the hint and are oblivious to it. You can just close your eyes for a bit and just let people know that you need some quiet time right then.
Anything to add to that, Patrick Smith?
Well, as a crew member, I think the worst example of passenger etiquette or lack thereof is just how filthy people are on airplanes nowadays. And I'm not talking about the people who put their bare feet up on the bulkhead, but the levels of garbage that people leave on airplanes. I mean, I've seen dirty diapers, you name it. I've walked up and down the aisles after a long-haul flight, and it looks like a hurricane blew through the cabin. I mean, there's just trash everywhere. And I don't understand where that mindset comes from. We don't throw our garbage on the floor in a restaurant
or at home,
even in public transportation. Why is it okay to do it on a commercial airplane?
Yes.
I think it's a manifestation, just another example of people's contempt for airlines and for the experience in general. But it's still just kind of awful.
Patrick Smith, we had our appreciative caller beforehand to congratulate on a nice landing that a pilot gave. I wonder, because some of our listeners would have experienced some sort of emergency landing, and this is where gratitude really comes into play. Years ago, as a matter of fact, I had a transatlantic flight that had an emergency landing. How often does that sort of thing happen?
Well, be careful with the term emergency landing, and this is something I talk about in the book as well. Most landings that people assume to be emergency landings are actually just diversionary landings, precautionary landings, and not an actual emergency. You know, there are any number of reasons planes divert, whether it's a passenger who is ill to some sort of equipment malfunction, rarely anything all that serious. And sometimes it does escalate into what is technically an emergency, but even that isn't to imply that the plane is you know, in any real danger of crashing.
Mm-hmm. What do you see in terms of future trends, Patrick?
I don't see a whole lot of change. Technology is changing slowly. One thing that worries me in the U.S. is just how much our airport infrastructure is lagging behind that I see elsewhere in the world. Some of the airports in Europe and across Asia especially are just astonishing.
In what way?
Just the technology, the passenger friendliness, the efficiency of these airports, everything from the way the runways are laid out to the amenities for the travelers in the terminals. I think a lot of other countries really get what a driver of commerce and economy air travel is, and they invest in their airports and in their airlines. And here we kind of treat the airlines really as cash cows, the way tickets are taxed and everything. Meanwhile, our airports are falling into decay, with some scattered exceptions. Unfortunately, it's the bigger airports that seem to be in the worst condition.
Right, right.
Whether it's LaGuardia or LAX, you know, these are our, you know, international gateway airports, and they just simply do not compare to what you would find in Bangkok or Munich or Dubai.
Okay, thank you very much, Patrick Smith, for spending the hour with us commercial airline pilot, hosting the website askthepilot.com, author of Cockpit Confidential. Patrick Smith, thank you.
Thank you, Ben. Anytime.
Sure thing. And Luann Alameo, thank you for joining us, of Luann Alameo and Associates, organization that consults on etiquette and image. We appreciate you taking part today.
Well, thank you for having me.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. And our host of Talk of Iowa just stepped into the studio, Charity Nebbe. How are you, and what's coming up tomorrow?
I'm great, Ben. Well, tomorrow, as a matter of coincidence, there are two new books out.
There are no coincidences in life. Okay, go on.
Written by people who grew up in the Amana colonies. And one of the books is called Growing Up in Amana, and the other one is Gardening the Amana Way. So tomorrow I will talk to the authors of both books, and we'll get an inside look at what it was like to grow up in the Amana colonies.
That sounds fascinating. Charity Nebbe, host of Talk of Iowa. Tune in tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Tune in tomorrow on this program when we'll talk about the ideas and proposals put forth at the anti-bullying summit going on now in Des Moines. We'll also hear from a young Iowan who was bullied and who now uses that experience to help others. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.